Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled Survival of the Fittest, Challenging Interior and Exterior Landscapes. A stark Australian landscape is both menacing and beautiful in Rachel Leary's Bridget Crack, with a protagonist who must overcome physical and psychological threats. David Wish Wilson's The Coves explores the brutality of Australian renegades in the unlawful streets of 19th century San Francisco, while Stephanie Parkin's Into the World forces her heroine to face ocean hazards while striving to protect a dangerous personal secret. Lisa Chaplin explores these authors' sources of inspiration and what it takes to create characters who battle internal fears in a fight for survival against nature and humanity.
Welcome to our Survival of the Fittest, Challenging Interior and Exterior Landscapes panel. This is actually a subject that's very dear to my heart. Historical readers, in essence, they buy books to be taken away from their life and time, whether they want to experience the internment camps of World War II, the brutality of Rome, or colonial Australia. It's our ongoing challenge as writers to transport them via our characters and books. Here with me today are three authors who have created very different worlds, yet connected by the latter part of the age of exploration. Stephanie Parkin's Into the World goes to the heart of the search for the great explorer La Pérouse, and the true story of a woman who escaped a desperate situation by becoming a sailor. Though she's not a true historical figure, Rachel Leary's Bridget Crack is an amalgam of several and very true to life, showing the brutality and strange beauty of the life for an escapee convict woman in early Tasmania. David Wish Wilson's The Coves follows the adventures of a boy looking for his lost mother, experiencing the brutality of life on board ship as a child, from the racism of Gold Rush San Francisco to the careless violence of Sydney Town. Another thing all three books have in common is the evocation of the best and the worst in humanity in its current setting. In The Tide Watchers, I found I had to go to northwestern France to get the feel, to talk to the locals, to get the rituals and their take on France's hidden attempt to invade England in 1803. In these books, from the sailors' rituals when ships cross the equator to the brutality of early bushrangers and some Aboriginal people defending their lives and land from invasion, and the scramble for supremacy, by shipmates after mutiny, the visuals in these three books will grab you and not let go. My first question's for Rachel. I'm interested in knowing why you chose to start Bridget Crack where you did, in Tasmania, long after her sentence, and not in the assizes of Britain, or where she even committed the so-called crime, or on the ship. Was it because all that's been done before, or did you just want to dive right into the character who refused to buckle under Britain's class system and found alive and well in Tasmania?
Someone was saying this morning, you know, that often when we write, we sort of end up writing about ourselves. And I think for me, this book is a lot of me sort of trying to process through my own relationship with Tasmania. So in that way, it's a very sort of Tasmanian story, and that was sort of the place that I had that relationship with. So that's probably sort of why it's centred there. Yeah, I did try and sort of avoid that sort of, some things that I sort of felt like I sort of as you said, had sort of been done or whatever. But yeah, and also I think the other thing that really interested me was that sort of colonial experience of the landscape. And I was really interested in, and also just from what I'd seen about the way people experience wilderness in Tasmania was this idea, and even earlier on, like colonial painters and that sort of thing, was that this idea that you can sort of go out into the landscape and paint something or photograph something or, you know, go for a bushwalk with all your stuff you can bring with you, and then, you know, you can return home and have a nice hot bath, you know. So, and then you can go, wow, that was beautiful, you know, like, or whatever. But then in reading about the bushrangers, I became intrigued about this question for me about what their relationship to that bush, which was incredibly unfamiliar to them as Europeans, might have been like, that they were sort of interacting with it in this way where, you know, that it wasn't sort of safe, sort of, they couldn't sort of just go and have this experience and then retreat to warmth and safety. Yeah. It was an incredibly different thing. So I suppose, you know, that wasn't necessarily my intention at the beginning, that would be a lot of what it was about. But as I read more about the bushrangers, that was more the thing that sort of... And I suppose because I, you know, I'd done a lot of bushwalking and whitewater rafting and stuff in Tasmania, so I had that sort of strong connection myself. So yeah, it was sort of that land, that those differing and how their situation and people from different classes and how all of those things affected that experience was sort of what started to interest me.
So basically it's you gave Bridget your connection to Tasmania, and as a woman who had to escape the situation.
Well, I guess there's another whole piece of that as well where my father's family, there was a lot of intergenerational violence and trauma. They were mostly Irish convicts initially. And so, you know, that was something that I'd always wondered what that was about. And so I started to look back into his family history and that story. And so I think part of my Tasmanian experience is this thing of trying to come to terms with violence and sort of, you know, also just starting to collect stories of, like, you know, he had I think it was his great-grandmother or something, died in a bush hut, married to a woodcutter, and she died giving birth to her 14th child in this, you know, bush hut. And they were very violent, Dad's side of the family. The men were really violent. So it was sort of me, sort of also that other part of it, the other side of it is that thing of... and then reading the archives, of course, all the Aboriginal history and even just, you know, convict women, the sorts of things that they went through, and, you know, most of them would have had PTSD when you read, sort of look at their behaviours. So the other part of that was me sort of... myself on this sort of trying to come to terms with the violence that I knew personally of that place, but that also I'd read about. Yeah.
Yeah. Steph, I was immediately drawn in by the true story of Girl Becomes Boy and the reasons for it. I related especially to this most ironic time in France, the era of liberty, equality, fraternity, and then it meant none of that for women. Could you explain to the audience just who Girardin was and how you found her story?
Marie-Louise Girardin was basically an ordinary woman, but who does this extraordinary thing where she disguises herself as a man and journeys around the world. And she was a daughter of a gardener. She grew up in Versailles. She was miles away from the sea. She would never have seen the sea before thinking up this plan to go, or, you know, coming up with the idea to journey around the world. So I had to have a way of her, you know, sort of even imagining how this would happen for her. But yeah, she is in a destitute place, so survival for her is of prime importance, because she's really done this thing that many people other women in that situation wouldn't have done. She's taken this risk. It's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire in a way, because what we know of her is that she was fleeing the wrath of her father, and that came from sailors' records, memoirs written 70 years later after the voyage. So she was an illegitimate mother. She had no means of support. Her family was abandoning her, basically. So she was left with this kind of choice of find a man or become one, and try and search for some independence and freedom that way. And like you said about the revolution, that was so ironic. And I love the fact that there was this chance to look at the women were searching for freedom and independence at this time, which I didn't know about. 100 years before the suffragettes, there were women also fighting for their right to vote and be regarded as citizens, while all of France was looking for this equality. So it was a fascinating chance to look at how she might be also doing this by going out of the mould, doing something different, pushing back.
Very different.
Yeah, the constraints of her society. Yeah.
So it was basically the animal farm of liberty, equality, fraternity. Some men were more equal than women.
Yes, that's right. And I loved being able to bring in that story of the women fighting for equality at that time by using her backstory and, you know, having some independence fighting to find that, yeah.
We'll get on to the ship with your next question, because that's the real challenging external landscape, isn't it? But Dave, I know from my history course at uni just how brutally young boys could be treated aboard ship, and not just in colonial Australia. What made you choose a child as a protagonist, and starting the book during a mutiny, the most dangerous situation that this young boy could be in?
There's a couple of parts to that answer. First part is a little bit silly, perhaps. So I've never written from a child's perspective before. But a couple of years ago, my then 7-year-old son came to me and he said, Dad, you're a writer. Can you write a book about me? Mm-hmm. And I said, I can't really do that. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why. And then he went away and he thought about it for a bit and he said, well, can you... quite a clever little fellow, can you write a book about a boy like me? And I thought, okay, well, maybe, but he's a quite sensitive kind of boy. So I filed that away, and then when I started doing this research for this period where these Australian gangsters kind of took over San Francisco in its first few years, I thought about what kind of point of view I'd like to tell the story from. And I knew that I didn't want to write a big doorstop of a novel despite all the research I'd done. And it seemed to me a child's perspective would be good because, I mean, I'm interested in the way children experience time. I mean, there's that old saying that we live 2/3 of our life before the age of 12, which is kind of a paradoxical statement until you think about it. I mean, as adults, we're so busy, we're never in the now. We always think about what we have to do next. Whereas kids, we can all remember those long, boring Sunday afternoons. Time is really slow. And because San Francisco in its first years was so chaotic, our population was growing so fast and there was so much violence, I wanted a kind of a quiet, still child's point of view to start to work through this story. And also because kids have things explained to them in dialogue, you don't need lots of exposition and all that kind of thing. But... I still didn't know whether the character would work. So I'm a crime fiction writer by trade. So crime fiction is the genre par excellence for examining, I think, human behaviour in extremis. And so what I did was to test Sam out, really, as a character. I put him on the boat with a bunch of other characters, and I didn't know if he was going to be the main character at that stage. I thought he might be, but there's nowhere to go. The ship's been pirated. I wanted to test his instincts for survival. And it's been taken over by a very brutal escaped convict. And over the course of the days that ensue in the opening couple of chapters, his instincts do prove to be sound. Although there's nowhere to run, he he finds a way to negotiate his freedom and survival and all of that kind of thing. That's really the reason why.
Yeah, he seems well above his years when he does those negotiations too.
Well, I think
and yet remained such a child. It was a really delicate balance that he had with Sam.
Yeah, well, I think a boy like Samuel, whose father was murdered, he's grew up as an orphan for a large period of time. He was in a Tasmanian boys' home. He's had to grow up very fast. But he's still a 12-year-old boy at the end. And like I said, part of my reason for writing the whole book was to explore the question of what happened to boys like my son, and boys like me for that matter, in those days. There have always been quiet, sensitive boys in the world. Were they brutalised and turned into brutes? Were they brutalised and then broken? Or were they able to find some way through the morass?
Surviving.
Yeah. Also brings a beautiful tenderness to the novel as well, and to those brutal times, doesn't it?
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, Rachel. I found the scene on page 239 of Bridget Crack very evocative. In fact, I couldn't stop singing the song Eleanor Rigby as I read it. It was just so a visual in my head. And I was also watching the Frankenstein Chronicles at the time, and the scene where the major character becomes Frankenstein's monster is dead and alive, and it takes place at the sea. That incredible, I don't know how to put it, almost like deadness. It stayed with me for a very long time. So how did you envision that scene? It's so incredibly lonely.
That's the one on the headland. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I suppose I think I'm probably quite visually in my imagination. So I did, have really strong images of the landscape when I was writing it. It also goes back to that sort of gothic thing, you know. There's this sort of history of people writing about Tasmania with its, you know, in a sort of fairly dark way. And I know I've had this conversation with a few Tasmanians, you know, because there's this... quite a lot of people have this thing about Tassie where they say that you can feel the history in the landscape. So a lot of people say you can, and I've always thought, why is that specific to Tasmania? Why, if you can feel the history in the landscape there, you must be able to feel it in other places. And I always thought, you know, is it the fog? You know, is it actually more a psychological thing? Is it the effect that fog and dense vegetation have on you? You know, it's almost like that primal reaction of like, yeah. I can't see out or...
And actually, the islands in Scotland feel very similar.
And islands. I think also islands have a fairly particular effect on us, which I don't completely understand. But it's interesting, that thing of relationship to place, because I know a few times I'd gone on walks in Tassie, and one time in particular where as I was walking, it was almost like the hairs on the back of my neck started to stand up, and I just had this feeling of... I don't think I'm supposed to be here in this place. Like, it was really strong. And, you know, and I always thought, let's say picking up on some kind of visual cues in my periphery. Was there something I could smell? Like, I'm always sort of trying to reason it away. But wonder if there is this sort of, do we have this sort of other part of us? And maybe is it a more of a sort of ancestral thing or a spiritual thing? Is there something that we're sort of picking up about and on? And, you know, I think, you know, sometimes standing out on those, the headland scene.
It's like the edge of nothing.
Well, it's interesting you say the edge of nothing, because one of the strong images I had when I was writing that book for all my characters was that they were all on the edge of a void. So I had this sense of each of my characters sort of walking around the edge of this void, and it was always about whether they were going to fall into it or not. But I do have a memory of standing on some of those headlands and having sometimes just this kind of eerie... They do have this sort of eerie, haunted feeling to them sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I just kept thinking, all the lonely people during that scene. It was amazing. Steph, as a child abuse counsellor's daughter, I loved the scene in pages 104 to 7 where Girardin is on board ship. She's trying to write her story to the son she had to give away. And it evoked a memory of slipping through a portal to childhood for her and then back again. It was short but really vivid. What was this when the idea of becoming a... You wanted to plant the idea of her becoming a male so she could accept it later?
Yeah, that's where a scene where she's finding... She gets through into the Garden of Versailles. Is that what you're thinking? Yeah, so it was a really important backstory scene that I wanted to put in for a character, I guess a character arc plot point as well, because this is a point in time where we meet Girardin. She's quite a damaged woman in the early parts of the story, what she's had to put up with. She's grieving the loss of her son that she's left behind. She's already had a previous... She's widowed from a previous marriage, lost another son previously, and she's had a domineering father and all these bad things happening to her, and so she's quite a damaged person. And I wanted her to remember a time about herself where she was brave and was curious and could do the sorts of things that I'm going to make her do in the voyage. and this moment where she pulls out the bricks from the wall and goes through from this muddy world of her gardener's shacks where she's living, and she doesn't tell any of her 9 brothers and sisters or any friends. She goes alone through, and it's a different world. It's the crisp green, the grasslands and the shiny statues and fountains, and so it feels like another world, and I wanted her to be able to remember that as the journey goes on, that she was once brave, was once curious.
And yet she couldn't write the letter to her son, yeah. And I found that real... I loved the irony of it because it was very human. Dave, the scene on page 80, oh my goodness, it just... As I read it, I just kept having a visual of the rake's progress in my head, and also, weirdly enough, that painting where there's a bunch of dogs playing poker. I had both in my head, and it was just competing for space. But I really loved the line, "You have a sensibility for words, and more too, I'd hazard. And you'd best hope life doesn't wring it out of you." Such something that people say to children, that they shouldn't. After such a voyage, no spoilers here, and into a town as greedy and violent as Gold Rush San Francisco, how does Sam remain so hopeful and so open to new cultures as he becomes?
Well, so in some senses he's incredibly vulnerable because there are not many children in the early days of San Francisco, and he's adopted by these Australian criminals. So in a sense he's very vulnerable, but in another sense he's actually very well suited to that kind of experience, and it goes back to his experience as a kid on the Swan River colony. So his father was murdered and he was adopted by a magistrate, but he really grew up in what was then called the Blacks Camp in the Swan Valley. So he learned to speak Noongar. He spent most of his time with Aboriginal people, which wasn't too uncommon in the early days of the Swan River colony. So he's got a sense of wonder about country and place, and this kind of breeds a sense of curiosity when he's there. So he's also, in a sense, following my own sense of curiosity, because I've always been interested in the Gold Rush populations, because there was chaos and there was violence and there was criminality and all of that kind of thing. But it was also... So the California Gold Rush in 1849, it was the largest internal human migration the world had seen to that time. It was an incredibly multicultural place. You had all kinds of people digging for gold. People from China, African Americans, Australians, New Zealanders, Maori people, people from Norway, Russians, South Americans. And yes, there were race riots and yes, there were lots of problems, but it was the first time really this kind of thing had happened on the planet. And then, of course, when gold was discovered in Australia, a lot of that population moved back here. And despite all of the chaos and the occasional bouts of violence, it seems to me everywhere this roving, marauding population went, they changed things slightly for the better. So in Victoria, it led the first, after the Eureka Stockade, the first example of male suffrage in Australia. And then that roving, marauding population moved to South Island, New Zealand with the Otago Gold Rush, where I think hitherto in South Island, New Zealand had been run basically as a almost a neo-feudal state by these retired British generals who wanted to set up this Arcadian lost world which had vanished from England. And then this they even knew that they knew that gold was there, but they kind of hid it. Then the people arrived and first examples of democracy kind of came about. So Sam, he's open to other cultures. In fact, he's very curious, and his best friend is a young Chinese girl, because like I said, there's not many children there. And she becomes his confidant, she becomes his ally, and she becomes his kind of girlfriend, I guess. But yeah, really he's following my sense of curiosity about that population and the possibilities inherent in it, despite all of the madness going on.
Okay, finally, Rachel. The closing scene of Bridget Crack is as simple and haunting as Pan Pipes at Night. I couldn't think of any other way to put it. I ached for the poor dog. What made you choose such an ending without too many spoilers?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the dog for me was quite a significant character in the book. And particularly, I think the dog's eyes are sort of in that scene, and I think I had this strong thing about, you know, dogs are so hopeful. A dog has to be sort of very damaged before it will give up hope, and they have a lot of faith in us and a lot of loyalty, and I think, you know, because in writing that book I had to confront so much difficult stuff. I mean, everything I've sort of put Bridget through, I put myself through, and you know, all the archival stuff. I mean, you know, I remember learning about Truganini at school, and then, you know, all the sort of stuff I read about this, like, you know, finding out that Truganini had seen her partner get his hands chopped off and then being gang raped by these sailors, and like this sort of stuff that you're sort of at that edge of kind of dealing with what humans do, you know. So, you know, I guess for me that question around the dog was, you know, do we deserve this dog's loyalty? Do we deserve this faith? And can we do better? You know, it's almost like for me that question was sort of there, is there with that dog and that and the hope and
the dog kind of became the landscape.
Well, I tried to make everyone become the landscape in a way. Like, I mean, so did Bridget in a way.
I mean in the sense that really the dog alone had that hopeful part of the landscape, whereas the humans really did not.
I think that for me that as I said, you know, the dog was a lot about hope, and that I think, you know, in the end for me that a lot of the book was sort of trying to sort of find the light in the darkness as well, you know, which, yeah.
Time stories, isn't it, to put some of that light in?
Well, yeah, and I often, you know, people sometimes have said to me, we were saying before, oh, you know, it's a difficult book, it's dark, and I was like, I actually went really easy on you. Like,
imagine telling Truganini's story when Truganini was raped up to 20 times
right.
a night.
And often I did really, do I put that in, do I don't put that in, how much do you tell, how much do you infer, you know, it's just like, I remember once someone saying, oh, you know, I'm going camping, I'm going to take your book to the beach. And I was like,
Alone.
And so, you know, you sort of think, you know, what you have, if you have this sense of a reader, you know, why do you want to put them through this stuff? Or what do you want to put them through? And I mean, it's tricky because there's always that sense of rage or outrage where you want to go, look, you know, like, and you kind of go, oh, yeah, maybe people already know that people can be really bloody awful. But then, I don't know, I've done a few talks, and when you kind of realise actually people, because that history's been hidden from us a lot, and a lot of people don't know, you know, that convict women were walked from one end of the island to another by an ex-convict who was now a police officer and probably generally raped her on the way, and there was no recourse for her. And, like, you know, because we live in this sort of, so much has been covered up. That I suppose for me there was that desire to do that, to just go, this is pretty not very good, you know.
And yeah, it needed to be told. Mm. Steph, I love the way that you brought the character of botanist La Bladière to life through his rather frustrating and very true to life description of how his team finds Claude Riche on pages 273 to 4. Did you find this in his own words, in Girardin's, or was it from imagination?
I'm glad you asked about this, because it was a really hard scene to write, but I actually had three different testimonies to have this encounter. This is where one of the naturalists goes off looking by himself on Esperance Bay in Western Australia and gets lost and is in, you know, dry, harsh conditions. And they can't find any sources of fresh water. So the ship captains and so forth want to leave. They've searched for a couple of days. They can't find any water. Everybody is running out. So they're thinking, we'll get out of here and save everybody. But Girardin, my character, is horrified that they might be leaving this guy behind and he'll be watching the ships drive away, sail away. So I chose in the end La Bladière's actual account. So I had his journals translated from French into English. And it was a brilliant example of how you, as an author, you can look at and glean character from the actual person's words. So it was an amazing example of having those words, I guess. And just his account was a similar sort of, he has this ordered chronological way of doing it. So even though his friend was lost out there, and he was really keen to find his friend, he was also still looking for botany, for, plants and the kangaroo paw that's on the cover, and he finds that there. And he tells you this, instead of just telling you the account of how the...
it's very funny.
Claude Riche comes back, just as the ships, the search parties are about to leave, he comes stumbling out of the bushes at the very last minute. So it was like an amazing scene that I had to use somehow. And I was able to, I had to tell it through Girardin's eyes because I'm doing it solely from her perspective. So she has to hear it from La Bladière, and then I could play in and get some of his characteristics from the way that he frustratingly writes with, chronologically ordered way of how he found this plant before.
And Claude. Exactly. Dave, the penultimate scene in the book felt so real, so breathtaking and yet terrifying in its harsh reality of the setting. And yet, through all of that, Sam continues to call Sarah Proctor. He never once deviates from this from the start of the book to the end, even though Sarah Proctor says he's like my little brother. What was the reason for this?
I think it's a sign of respect, I guess. So when we first meet Sarah Proctor on the same boat that Sam Bellamy is on, she's a survivor. She's prepared to betray him to survive, if that's what it takes. But when they reach San Francisco, she kind of adopts him. I mean, one of the things about some of the violence, which is necessary in this story because it's how it was, but also it serves to kind of foreground the acts of decency and generosity that Sam is a beneficiary of. And one of the main people who takes him under her wing is Sarah Proctor. All the men who Sam knows are known by their surname. He can't quite, because she's older than him, he can't quite bring himself to call her Sarah, although she calls him Sam. So she's kind of Sarah Proctor. And she's a bit of an amalgam of people I've known over the years. There was a crazy time in my life when my girlfriend was a working prostitute and most of my friends were working prostitutes. And some of them were quite damaged and some of them were on the way to being quite damaged and some of them no, there were never that kind of cliched hooker with a heart of gold. Everyone was very tough because it was a very tough kind of world. But I was a beneficiary at a very young age of that kind of kindness. So yeah, it's almost autobiographical, that bit.
So it fitted into the landscape, really, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. How much time do we have, Lisa? 10 minutes. Each of the... I'd like to throw it to you. Are there questions, or would you like each author to read a short excerpt from their novel? Read? Okay, reading it is. Okay, Rachel, if we can get a wind up for it at maybe two and a half minutes.
Oh yeah. So I just read this is a bit sort of when this is a convict woman. She gets lost in the bush. She runs away from where she is because her master's not great. It's not a great situation. So she runs away into the bush, and this is when she first gets lost. It had been this way, she was sure. She had not come far off it, not that far. So where was it? She turned around, trees and bushes, no break in them. How could a track just go, just disappear? Panic wrapped its hand around her guts and squeezed. Behind her there was a noise, a branch cracking. She spun around. Her heart jumped like a frog in a bottle. Kangaroo. Just a kangaroo, that's all. Just a kangaroo. She walked a few yards, stopped. The track was close by. It was close by here somewhere. It had to be. She'd been on it not long ago. She walked one way, then another. Branches snagged her dress and scratched her arms. Her foot went down into a hole. She fell forward hard, got up again, walked a few paces and stopped. Twilight. A pale gold moon presented itself, called forth an army of stars. She hit the side of a fist into the tree trunk next to her. Bugger you! Bugger you! Bugger you! Bugger! Bugger! She slid down to the base of the tree. The sounds were of birds, a thump thump as a kangaroo made its way through the forest. Every direction looked the same, glimpses of grey sky through a net of leaves and branches. She pushed her way through ferns and cutting grass, there being no top to the hill, only an ongoing mess of scrub that scratched her, hooked her, tripped her. She fell and lay there among it all, her body given up to it, until her will rose up biting and she was moving again. She ran until her chest hurt and her breathing was hard. She stopped halfway up another slope. Around her damp rock leaked silence, preached cold, stubborn stillness. Wet shadows lurked in cracks big enough for someone, something to hide in. Scraggly trees clung to the side of rock, their roots pushing down into shallow dirt, collected on ledges and in crevices. Their thin branches hung at queer angles, shivered in a whisper of wind. When she stood again, she was in a gully, a rock wall behind her, a trickle of water running down it. Opposite her, the slope was dense with trees, dark playing around their trunks. Her dress was torn, there was a gash on her leg, blood stuck to the shredded stocking around it. She licked the water, then sat down against the dry end of the wall. Above her, clouds laced with pink and orange drifted, the day out there taking its time to die its pretty death. She ate a piece of damper, pulled her knees in close to her chest.
You can see what I mean. The dark evocation of the story is quite haunting. Steph?
I'm going to read a piece that talks about how I've tried to find external landscape difficulties that coincided with my character's internal journey. So with a true story, I guess I was always looking for these events that could be turned into something that was going to tell more about the internal world of the character too. So this is an abridged sort of skim through of a shipwreck scene. Outside, a bell began to clang. All hands on deck. She looked at her hands. What use was she on deck? What did she know of sailing? A fist thudded on her door. She left her cabin and followed the men as they scrambled up the stairs. The wind battered her face. She narrowed her eyes against its sting. Looking down, the waves swirled and foamed like washing waters. All about the ship, wave-beaten rock circled them. To the north, south, east and west, the reefs had drawn a noose around them. Beside her, the chaplain whispered his prayers. He smiled grimly at her. God will save us. She thought of La Perouse and his ships. He was supposed to have sailed this same route past these reefs of New Caledonia. Had they become stranded here? Had they too prayed to God to save them? She could imagine now the fate of La Perouse and his crew. She saw their ships splintered on these reefs, the men forced to bake in the tropical sun, their skin peeling from them, their lips caked in salt. How long would their provisions have lasted, their water? Would they have risked swimming to shore and been plucked off by sharks or other monstrous creatures? The general called to the surgeon, "Monsieur Renard, kindly fetch our captain from his bedchamber." Captain Darabeau staggered to the quarterdeck. For once, she felt sorry for him, pulled from his sickbed, only to face certain death. He looked dazed. Palsy crippled the whole left side of his body. Labaladier scowled. Darabeau took the helm. He spun the wheel and turned their bow towards the reef. The Recherche picked up speed. They surged at the reef. "What's he doing?" Sheridan cried. "Saving our lives," Armand grunted. "Lend a hand, for God's sake." Sheridan took her place among the seamen. She gripped a rope. All around her, the sailors and soldiers, civilians and officers stood ready. The carpenters and cooks stood shoulder to shoulder with the gunners and sailmakers, all hands together. She licked her dry lips. She felt the wind whisper around her neck, her ears against her cheek. Her feet were planted and she could feel every movement of the ship through her soles, her knees, her hips, like a message. She felt the skittish mood of the ship as she rode the waves ever faster towards the reef.
How's that for evoking a life on board ship? Especially as a woman trying to pass herself off as a young man, trying to do something. All right, Dave.
Okay, so this is Sam's first job in San Francisco. He's working as a tout and he's leading some American soldiers down towards the Australian area, which was called Sydney Town, where the bars and brothels are. It's the first time he's been separated from his dog, who's his best friend as well, who he brought from Australia.
Sorry? How old was he at the time?
12. And this is pretty much as Sydney Town was described in the San Francisco newspapers at the time. From the alleys and porches, dark eyes watched them descend toward the docks. Sam could feel the hunger in those eyes. Men in slouch hats leaned on horse rails and smoked pipes in the glow of campfires set against the muddy borders of the street crossings. This was called Pacific Street, but like all of the street signs in that precinct, the poles had been cut down and turfed into the muddy holes that were said to be fathomless, where donkeys had drowned in liquid mud and some drunks too, according to Kane. The Australians had dragged abandoned crates, packing cases and heavy timbers from the port and thrown them in the mud pits, but the sinkholes just drank them up and thirsted for more. Sam indicated for the riders to follow his footsteps around the edges of the worst drains. In single file, they continued toward the shoreline, while the loiterers stared from the darkness and willed them to fall. The Americans didn't seem so ferocious now, their nerves strained with watching the alleys and shadows. Sam imagined them veterans of Indian wars, well used to the hellish semaphore of silence that forewarned every enemy attack. But now the sounds of the Australian grog houses could be heard, and the men spat and began to smile, and whoever had cocked his revolver uncocked it, and the man beside Sam slapped his back. It was a fiddle playing a shanty to a sing-along of many voices, in competition with a piano and squeeze box from further along the shoreline. And now there were gunshots and laughter and singing, and somebody was playing the spoons, and elsewhere a choir of ukuleles ran down a medley of national anthems at a comical pace. They rounded the corner and Sam let the men take in the length of the shoreline street, with its welter of sounds and hundreds of people in the packed roadway between the establishments. The men seemed undecided or somehow hesitant, so Sam took the bridle of the nearest man's pony and indicated they should follow. He weaved through the tottering drunks and loiterers, and other men gathered in silent communion, whose eyes stared into every face and toward every pocket so that they might eat. Sam looked behind, and the Americans had formed a wary line, and their eyes too looked into every face. Sam paraded the Americans past Keane's grog house, and the tattooed youth called Barr, who'd questioned him earlier about eating his dog, tilted his head toward the stables at the termination of the street.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. www.cultfromsessionshell.com.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.